Okay, so back to E&M. Just a couple of announcements. I did post my solutions to problem set number one. Even if you thought this problem set was, very simple and straightforward, I strongly recommend that you read through my solutions. It's possible I use different methods to solve that would be good for you to know about. And especially the last problem, there's a very common mistake that is often made. I don't know if some of you have made it, that would lead you to think the force on capacitor plates has an opposite direction, depending on whether the plates have fixed charge or fixed voltage. And the resolution of this apparent paradox, since the force is actually, of course, the same in both cases, the resolution to that requires that you take into account the energy provided by the power source that held the plates at constant voltage. So anyway, I wrote up the details of that in some detail in my solutions, and I suggest you read through that, especially if this is not all clear to you from your undergraduate E&M courses. Second, don't forget about homework set number two that's due a week from Friday. And please do come to my office hours, especially if you have trouble with these homework. They start to accelerate now in difficulty, I would say, compared to the first set. Okay, so the start of section of Japson chapter 2 is we're going to begin in section 2.1, looking for how to solve boundary problems, problems where there is some surface boundary condition, like maybe some conductors are held at constant voltage, or you've dumped some charge on some conductors, things like that. And now you put another charge near those conductors, and how do you find the electrostatic potential in those cases? You can't just grab the Coulomb's law integral for in the form of the potential version and integrate, because you don't really know in advance where all the charges are. You don't know how they're going to get distributed on the conductor and so on. So, but one interesting thing is that you learned about last week, I think, the uniqueness theorem. And that means that if we can find by hook or by crook some way, find a potential that works and fits the boundary conditions, then that is the solution. And you don't have to wonder, well, the method I use seemed pretty screwy. Well, you don't have to worry about that. If it fits the boundary conditions and obeys Poisson's equation in the volume V of interest, then you're done. So in particular, this method of guessing, sort of, or having a hypothesis about a form of a solution is most clearly applied in the method of images. Which has limited usefulness because it mostly applies to problems with really great symmetry. And so the idea is, in general, we want a solution inside our volume V of interest. And that means often we have some charges, and by superposition, we can start by considering one charge often inside the volume V of interest. And the idea is that if there are some boundary conditions that we're trying to simulate, you can introduce some charges outside the volume V of interest. They absolutely have to be outside of V. Right, because if you stuck one inside, then you know del squared phi would have a singularity at this point if you stuck an image charge inside this V. So we know we can't do that, but it's completely fair game just to place them outside of the volume V where you want the potential. And the idea is that these will simulate the boundary conditions. And a key thing to remember is that any charge in your full system, when you're calculating the potential, any charge in the universe, in particular one placed outside of our volume V, it'll obey Laplace's equation inside V. Right, and that's simply because we know del squared of 1 over the distance between a vector x and another x naught, which would be the potential, with except for the 4 pi epsilon naught factor, due to any image charges outside, right? This would be 0 inside V if x naught is outside. And in particular, this del squared holds everywhere except it would only not hold near x, a point x naught. So if we put it in here, then it would be violated. But if it's outside, it's never violated for any point inside. Okay, so the simplest problem, you probably all saw this in your undergraduate courses, is the grounded conducting plane. So we have a infinite grounded plane. Sometimes I indicate that with this kind of symbol to indicate that the conductor is grounded. And now we're going to imagine a charge Q a distance away from that plane. Distance D. And let's say for this problem today, we'll call the volume V the region to the right side of the plane. Okay. That's where we want to have to find the potential, the electric potential, everywhere in that volume V to the right. Okay, and the idea is that, of course, Q creates a potential, a positive potential along this if we pretend the plane, the conductor, is not there. And if we simply, by symmetry, add a minus Q, an equal distance D to the left, that produces equal and opposite potential at every point that cancels, and this will satisfy then the boundary condition of the problem, which is, because this is a conductor, the potential has to be constant, and because we saw the word grounded, when you see that word, this phi equals zero boundary condition needs to spring into your mind. Okay. And I guess I'm going to call the coordinate normal to this plane my z-coordinate. Okay, so now we have this boundary condition that phi is 0 at z equals 0. And if we now calculate the potential everywhere to the right using the true charge Q and add also the potential due to the image charge negative Q, it will satisfy this boundary condition and it will obey Poisson's equation in the volume V. Right, so I'm not going to go through the math, but one could pick up a vector x, right, and one could add the potential at x due to this plus q charge that would involve this vector from q to the point p, often called the observation point p, and as I'm working through these problems. And then I would also need this distance, which you can calculate as a little exercise in trigonometry. And you've got the potential, electric potential everywhere. But I'm not going to go through any more details of that. You might want to do it just to make sure you know how to do that and could do it really quickly if you were asked to, like on an exam. Okay, so right away we move to the next less trivial example of a grounded conducting sphere. Let's say it has radius A and let's consider a point charge Q outside of this grounded conducting sphere. If I wanted to stress that it's grounded, I might show like a thin wire going far away that is indicating that it's grounded. And now let's put our charge Q somewhere here in the universe at a vector y from the center. And I'm going to indicate the magnitude of the vector y by just y without a vector over it. And the unit vector pointing toward q will come into our algebra. I'll call that n hat, the unit vector. And now we are interested in, let's say, the potential outside. Some vector x. So yeah, that's our point P. Sometimes I call that the observation point. Let's see, yeah. Actually, I've already mixed up my notation. This, I guess I've called in the notes n hat prime and the vector x, just to get consistent notation. That's has the distance x from the center and at a unit vector n hat prime and some angle gamma between these two vectors. Okay, so the idea here is to place an image charge inside the sphere, which will be outside our volume of interest. Our volume of interest is outside, so we are free to stick an image charge inside. At the moment, we don't know the magnitude of this, and we don't know the position. But by symmetry, we expect it's pretty clearly going to have to lie along this line that points to Q. So we'll call this unknown distance from the center y prime without the vector, but give it the same unit vector as the vector to q. So somewhere is going to be this q prime at a distance y prime. And we don't know either of those yet, but the idea is if you have a reason to believe this might work, you can try this sort of arrangement and then see if by a suitable choice of y prime and q prime you can satisfy the boundary condition. That's the logic here. So let's set up the algebra. Okay, so what is 5x due to these two charges in the universe? It will be 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. There will be the electrostatic potential from the real charge in the system, which has the distance between the vector x n hat minus y n hat prime, and then it will be plus whatever is the charge on the image charge, which we haven't found yet, divided by the distance from x n hat to y prime n hat prime. So this, again, we only care about this expression outside of the sphere. Now we're going to demand that this potential has to obey the boundary condition that was stated, the grounded sphere boundary condition. So I'll state that this way. Let's demand that that phi at x equals a is 0. And to simplify some algebra, I will go ahead and multiply phi times 4 pi epsilon naught. That's also 0. And so this has to be obeyed, a squared plus y squared minus 2ay cosine gamma to the 1 half, right, is the distance from charge q to the observation point, and then we'll have q prime over a squared plus y prime squared minus 2ay prime cosine gamma to the 1 half. So at first glance, this might look a little troubling. We have one equation, but two unknowns, but actually that's not quite true, because this has to hold at all values of gamma. And so, in fact, we have, it looks actually, if you think about it, an overspecified equation. We have many more equations to be satisfied than the number of unknowns. So it's not obvious without going through the algebra whether it's actually solvable, but it turns out it is solvable. The algebra goes as follows. If we define n hat dot n hat prime as cosine gamma, then we can rewrite this equality as q prime over q equals minus a squared plus y prime squared minus 2ay prime cos gamma to the 1 half over a squared plus y squared minus 2ay cos gamma to the 1 half. This tells us right away that q prime over q is going to be a negative number, which we'll keep in mind because we're going to square both sides of this equation, losing the sign information, which we'll have to impose later. whenever you have equations like this with the square roots and you're trying to simplify it, normally you want to proceed by squaring both sides of the equation. Do I want to keep that diagram? Maybe I'll keep it for a while. So when you square this and collect terms, again, I'll spare you some of the algebra. You get these equations, q prime over q squared times a squared plus y squared minus a squared plus y prime squared. A term that's independent of cosine gamma. Sorry, that was meant to be a square bracket. And then cosine gamma times another term, minus q prime over q squared times 2ay plus 2ay prime. Okay. And that all has to equal 0. And because it has to hold for all gamma, this basically each of these two separate square brackets have to vanish. And that gives two equations and two unknowns. And I will, again, I'll spare you that algebra. Just write the solution. You can check this in your vast spare time if you want to make sure you really understand this problem. And what we find is that q prime over q has to be minus a over y. If a charge has been put a distance y away, then the charge inside has to be of magnitude minus a over y. And the position of the charge has to be y prime is a squared over y. And that then allows you now to write the potential and calculate anything you want outside the sphere. Just by pretending there is no sphere, essentially, and adding the potential due to the real charge and the image charge. So let me go through, let me go at least write that expression again. It's, or maybe we did already. Well, yeah, of course it is this expression, except for 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, and one would have to plug in the values of q prime and y prime. So it's basically that expression. Let me go ahead and write it. So we're going to use it to calculate some other quantities. So phi depends on the distance of the charge, which is y, but it depends on how far out is the observation point, that is x, and it depends on this gamma, the angle between the charge and the observation point. Okay, so it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught q over x squared plus y squared minus 2xy cos gamma to the 1/2. Right, whenever you see these absolute value signs involving a distance between two vectors, what you want to do is square this vector and then take the square root. All right, so you get the x squared and you get the plus y squared and you get the minus 2xy n hat dot n hat prime. And then the second term looks like q prime, which is minus qa over y. And then you have the distance to the image charge, which is x squared plus a squared over y squared, that's y prime squared, minus 2x a squared over y cosine gamma all to the 1/2. Okay, and this formula for the potential is valid for all x greater than a and for all y greater than a. So once you have the potential outside the sphere, you can calculate many, many things that could be of interest. One of those things of interest is, what does the charge look like on the sphere, on the surface of the sphere? So let's explore that. And in many problems with conductors, this is one of the things you'll want to calculate, because this tells you, once you know that, you know not only the charge, you know the electric field just outside, you know you can calculate the pressure on that part of the sphere, and so on. So we learned before, what is the electric field discontinuity at the surface of a conductor, right? So let me remind you this situation. If we have like vacuum outside what I'll call region one and a conductor on the inside of a surface, region two, and we define the outward normal unit vector pointing into region one, so we called N1 hat prime. I'm writing this kind of carefully because, again, it's so easy to get signs wrong if you're not careful. There's an electric field outside, there's an electric field inside. And what we derived earlier is the discontinuity at the surface will obey this equation, that E1 minus E2 dotted into the N1 hat normal unit vector, this has to equal the charge on the surface, charge per unit area on the surface at each point on a conductor. Okay. So in this case, we know the electric field is zero inside the conducting sphere. And so we can see that E2 vanishes here, and we have simply that sigma is minus epsilon naught d phi dr at r going through positive values greater than a, approaching a in that limit, which I'll indicate in this notation. And here I've switched over just to a notation where I've replaced the distance x by r, because then I like that notation a little better. It looks more like a radius. Okay, so you can take this derivative easily enough. I won't go through every step of doing that. You get q over 4 pi a squared times a over y times 1 minus a squared over y squared, and divided by 1 plus a squared over y squared minus 2a over y cosine gamma all to the 3/2 power. Okay, so that's a sketch of how you calculate the charge per unit area on the conducting surface in a problem involving the method of images. One interesting thing is when you derive a formula like this, okay, you look at it and you think, okay, that's great. There's all sorts of stuff and algebra and trigonometry. But you can get a little more insight into like maybe what it means by looking at the formula in different limits. So let's consider the limit that the charge outside the sphere is very far away from the sphere. Try to get some insight. Did I scare away like half of the class or something? Am I really that scary? Okay. Limit as y gets much greater than a. So we're moving the charge farther and farther away. So sigma goes in that limit to minus q over 4 pi a squared. And we have the a over y factor. And what I'm going to do is expand everything to leading order and to at least linear order in A over Y, but neglect terms of quadratic order, A squared over Y squared, which would be some higher order correction. So to do that, we can ignore this A squared over Y squared in the numerator, and do, I think I call this the second rule of theoretical physics. We do a binomial expansion of what's left. And again, ignoring the quadratic term, that next term after the 1 will be a minus 3 halves times minus 2a over y. Cosine gamma. All right. And again, I'm neglecting these terms of order a squared over y squared. So if I multiply that out and simplify, it looks like minus q over 4 pi a y minus 3 q over 4 pi y squared cosine gamma. Okay, and there are going to be correction terms of order a over y cubed if I had gone farther with this series. So we can look at that and we can interpret it. Remember, y is a very large number here. Think of it approaching infinity. And so what does this look like? This looks basically like a small net charge. At very large distances, y, very small net charge. And then there is a second term, which looks like a very small dipole, electric dipole, which is not surprising because, right, we had a sphere and there are two charges in this universe, a negative charge inside and the real charge very, very far away. So it ends up looking like on the surface of the sphere, it kind of looks like a charge density due to an electric dipole. Another thing that's kind of interesting, actually, about this problem is that you can calculate the total charge on the sphere by doing the surface integral, the volume enclosing the conductor of sigma dA. And you can see if you do that integral, it's equal to q prime, which is minus qa over y at all distances y. And so the magnitude of the surface charge adds up. In fact, this is now real charge distributed on the sphere. if you add all that up, it turns out to be exactly equal to the charge we found on the image charge, that we, our fake charge that we placed inside. Now another interesting thing we can calculate, which actually will teach us some interesting things, we could calculate the force on the charge Q, the electrostatic force on Q. That's an observable, measurable quantity. So there are actually, I think I'm going to talk about this, three different methods because it gives some insight. So method one is we have the fake image charge there, but let's ignore that fact. There are also real charges on this sphere distributed, which we found, the sigma that depends on gamma, right? We know the real charges, if Q is here outside the sphere, these charges are all at a distance A from the center, and they differ depending on the angle we look at on the surface. So we can calculate the force by taking every little bit of charge using Coulomb's law, find the force on Q due to that little infinitesimal bit of charge on the surface. And this is the most reliable way of doing it in principle. This is the method that has no uncertainty over whether we're doing tricks with image charges, which you always have to be somewhat careful about. So this is what I'm going to do with method one. Add up all the infinitesimal forces from every little bit of surface through basically Coulomb's law. So this is method one. We're going to integrate force from each bit of charge that looks like sigma dA prime. Each little bit is going to provide an infinitesimal force. Okay, so that requires a bit of calculation. Let's pick, let's draw our sphere. Let's write our charge Q out here where we want the force vector. We have, let's consider a little bit of charge at a given gamma away from this axis pointing toward Q. And we'll need a little trigonometry, so let me draw some auxiliary things of interest. The line from this bit of charge here. But in fact, we know that what is going to happen, this will produce a dF, that particular bit of charge I drew. But when I go around the azimuth and add up all of these, right, I'll get dFs in all these directions, which will cancel out, except finally we expect the final force vector has to be along this line. So what we can do to, as a shortcut, we can consider this set of all phi from 0 to 2 pi and calculate that the infinitesimal force at Q due not just to this little bit up here, but to the entire 2 pi radians around azimuthally around that. Okay, so we need, of course, then to set up that calculation. First, the differential, and then we'll have to integrate it. So the df due to that entire 2 pi radians looks something like the following. Let me write a few other distances I'm going to need. I'll call capital R the distance from every point on that loop, that circular loop, which goes from gamma to gamma plus d gamma, let's say. This R is a squared plus y squared minus 2ay cos gamma to the 1/2. That's that distance. And we will also need this distance to do the trigonometry. Basically, there will be cosine of this angle, we call it theta, that we'll need to get the component along that vector pointing at Q. And for that, I'll use this will be y minus a cosine gamma, right? I subtracted y, I subtracted off this part to get this length. And so this divided by r will be the cosine of this angle theta we need just to get this one component of the force pointing away from the sphere through from Q. Okay, so df in, dotted into the y-hat direction. I guess I called that n-hat earlier, but I guess you know what I mean. That's an important rule. You should always listen to what I mean and not necessarily to what I say or write. Okay, so again, this is my differential area element dA between gamma to gamma plus d gamma. And this differential will have this cosine theta factor, y minus a cosine gamma over r, and now times q over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared. And then there's sigma of gamma, and then the the area of this will be 2 pi a squared sine gamma d gamma. Okay. So that's the y component of df, which is the only non-zero component. Okay. So I go through some simplification. Maybe I'll spare you a step of algebra and of doing this integral. It turns out not to be a hard integral, but I think I won't drag you through that. Fun though that would be. And write the answer. You can check it like with Mathematica if you want when you get home. And you get a q squared over 8 pi epsilon naught, and a times y squared minus a squared. And then there is a 2y over y squared minus a squared quantity cubed times y hat. And this final simplification I did in Mathematica. I admit, I cheated. Which actually simplifies because there's a y squared minus a squared here that cancels one of these powers. And I wrote the simpler form in the notes. Okay, so that is the most concrete, explicit way to do this calculation, but it seems a little complicated. And something in our brain is telling us, well, maybe it's just the force due to the image charge. maybe I didn't have to do all this integral stuff. So that is method two, which happens to work here, but I think I always would worry if there are factors of two, if I hadn't actually convinced myself that this gives the same answer. Just calculate the force on Q due to Q prime at Y prime. That gives the exact same answer. Now that you know it, if you need to find that force, like on an exam, and I don't tell you that you have to do it this hard way, then you can do it the simple way in one line. There's a third way you could use that is sometimes useful in these problems. You could reverse the force calculation and instead calculate the force Q causes on the sphere. Calculate the force that sphere feels. I guess I called that in the notes method three. Take the negative of the force caused by Q on the sphere. And basically we're invoking Newton's third law. That also gives the same answer. Okay. Most of you saw that problem as undergraduates, is that right? Anybody not see that problem before? This method of images for the sphere? No? You've all seen it. Good, good. It's review. There is a variation of this problem which kind of shows an interesting point of physics. So let me talk about the variation of this problem. Slight change, which is a whole different section of Jackson, section 2.3. We're going to still have a conducting sphere, but it's not grounded. So again, it will have radius A. But now, instead of having phi equals 0 as our boundary condition on it, all we know is that it carries total charge Q and the fact that it's a conductor. Now, this would be different if it were a dielectric and we put on charges on it. Then you would have to be given more information. You'd have to be given the distribution of the charges on it. But now we have the fact that it's a conductor. So we know it has a constant potential. It's not zero necessarily, but the sphere has constant potential. How does that change this solution? Okay, well, let's think about this, kind of try to approach it with some physical insight. Remember before when we had put a charge outside at Q at this distance y, that it induced an amount of charge on the sphere. It sucked out from the power supply that was grounding the conductor, or the piece of metal that was grounding the conductor that could supply charges freely. It sucked out of that source, that wire, an amount of charge Q prime, and distributed it over the surface of this sphere. And that amount was minus Q A over Y, we found. And that was necessary to make this the sphere surface an equipotential, constant potential everywhere on the surface. So the idea of this solution that I'm going to invoke is, well, now we've been given some different number, Q, to be on this chart, on this sphere. So how can we solve this problem? Let's start dumping little amounts dQ on here and calculate the potential after we've built up the charge to the final value Q on the sphere that we were given. So that basically that works out as follows. We know that we'll have to add to our old solution, we'll have to add a new amount of charge I'll call Q new, which is Q minus Q prime, because there is already a charge Q prime on effectively on the sphere when it was set up for our zero potential. So again, when I say this is added, this will be added to our previous solution, and we'll calculate the potential due to this new charge. Our previous grounded sphere solution. That's the logic. Now, here's the physics point that I guess I had to think about the first time I heard this argument, a long time before I really totally believed it. But I think it's true. That when you add on an extra amount dQ, you're probably wondering, where did this charge go? And the fact is that, right, this old sphere had equalized all the had basically arranged itself so that all the electric fields were normal at the surface, like this E1 dot n hat. All the electric fields are in that direction. So if I dump some charge on the sphere, there is no sideways component that would drive the charge in one direction or another. It must spread out symmetrically, totally symmetrically over the sphere. All this extra charge I add. And so as a result, this new charge that we are going to add, it will be a spherical distribution of charge added to the charge density that we derived for the grounded sphere. And we can calculate the potential outside simply then by adding the potential due to a spherically symmetric charge distribution Q nu, which is totally symmetrical. But that, again, we have linear equations in electrostatics. We've derived the potential outside a spherically symmetric charge distribution. It's all the same potential outside as if it were all located at the exact center of the sphere, right? This was found by Gauss's law. And so what this means is we can take our old solution for the grounded sphere. And simply add Q nu over 4 pi epsilon naught at the observation point, which we called X, right? And that's the solution to this problem. With that value of Q nu, which is Q minus little q prime. So that's a key point in solving this. You really need to understand this reasoning, why the charge you add now to the old problem, why it goes spherically symmetrically over the sphere, and then you can use that to trivially write the new addition that this causes to the potential. If you like, I could write out that solution then for this problem in 2.3. You'll have the 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. You'll have the q over x minus y. We saw before, for the grounded case, we'll have the minus aq over y, 1 over the distance from x to y prime. And now we have the third term, which is capital Q plus a over y, little q over x. Okay, the next problem I wanted to treat is Jackson's section 2.5, which is another interesting problem that can be solved with the method of images. We're going to go back to a grounded conducting sphere. But instead of placing a charge outside it, we're going to place it into an external electric field. Okay, so imagine there are capacitor plates very, very far away, and we're going to say that those were set up with some electric field between them. And now that's going to do something to our grounded sphere with a cable far away is the ground wire connected to it. And so let's say that the external electric field far away from the sphere, you're given its magnitude, E naught, and its direction is the z-axis. So one way we can set that situation up is with two image charges. We can use to, I shouldn't call them image charges, because this is our volume V is going to be the volume outside the sphere. Remember, we're not free to put image charges in that volume. But I guess I should call them fake charges. And you'll see why it's allowed in a second. We're going to simulate this electric field as an electric field caused by two charges that are infinitely far away and of infinite magnitude. So eventually they will really be off to infinity, and every point at a finite distance in volume V will be correctly described. Okay, so if I have like a Q1 here, I guess I'll call it Q1 prime, capital Q1 prime to the left, and capital Q2 prime to the right, I'll place those symmetrically, Z1 prime at minus capital R, and Z2 prime at plus capital R. Then, right, the electric field at the center of the sphere, and I'm going to eventually take the limit, capital R going to infinity. The electric field at the center of the sphere at z equals 0 will, of course, be z hat times q1 over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared minus q1 prime minus q2 prime over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared. Right, so we are going to equate that to equal E0 z hat, and that'll tell us the values of the equal and sorry, I just confused myself. All right. Now I'm reoriented. Okay, so yeah, Q1 prime, then we are going to say that will equal 2 pi epsilon naught R squared E naught, and we're going to choose Q2 prime to equal minus 2 pi epsilon naught R squared E naught. And if we do that, then this cancels out and equals E naught for that choice. And so we can now take away the external electric field. It's going to be represented by these two fake charges that we're going to eventually take the limit as R goes to infinity. And we can solve this problem with image charges, okay? So we know there will be a charge Q1 double prime now, which is actually the image charge of our fake charge Q1, and there will be an image charge of Q2 prime, an image of our fake charge Q2 prime. The position of Q1 prime, the distance or the z1 coordinate is z1 double prime is minus a squared over r, and of this one, z2 double prime is at a squared positive over r. And the magnitude of q2 double prime is minus q2 prime a over r. And the magnitude of Q1 double prime is minus Q1 prime A over R. Okay. So now we can calculate the potential at any observation point P outside the sphere just by taking those four point charges, two fake and two image of the fake, adding their electrostatic potential at P and take the limit after doing that limit as R goes to infinity. So let's go through, at least write down some of that math. So the potential outside the sphere will be the limit as R goes to infinity of a bunch of terms, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught q1 prime over r squared plus, let's say the observation point P is a distance r and an angle theta off of our z-axis. So this will be capital R squared plus little r squared minus 2 little r big R cos pi minus theta to the 1/2. It's a nice thing about potentials is they have no direction. You can just add the potentials. And then you've got 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, the image minus a q1 over r all over a squared over r squared plus r little r squared minus 2 little r a squared over capital R cos pi minus theta, the 1/2. Then we have the q2 and its image, q2 prime 4 pi epsilon naught, capital R squared, little r squared, is 2rr cos theta, the 1/2, and 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, minus a q2 prime over r all over a squared over capital R squared plus little r squared minus 2r a squared over capital R cos theta all to the 1/2. Okay. It looks a little bit messy and long, but to take the limit as r goes to infinity, I think the easiest way is to expand everything to leading orders in r until you find an order where everything did just cancel out and give zero. So let's remember our binomial theorem, which hopefully is kind of in your hip pocket, ready to be used at a moment's notice, right? Let me remind you, in case it isn't, 1 plus epsilon to the gamma. If epsilon has absolute value less than 1, as these two terms and the next term, is so on. So in the notes I gave a line of algebra applying this. And then a whole bunch of cancellation appeared. And actually it turned out we only needed the terms linear and cosine theta. So really this much of the power series was enough, the 1 plus gamma epsilon. if it had turned out to be zero, what you always want to do is go to the first non-zero term in problems like this. If the first term is zero, you don't just say, oh, the answer is zero. You usually keep going until you find a non-zero term, unless they're all zero. Let me skip that algebra of doing that. It's not very inspiring to watch me do algebra at the board. So I'll just write the two leading terms that one gets that survive. You get the original potential due to a constant field that you expect to be there. But now you have a contribution caused by the presence of the conducting sphere that looks like E naught A cubed over R squared cos theta. And that is the answer. And notice it doesn't have any capital R in it. So all the other terms that have some power of 1 over R and vanish in the limit as R goes to infinity. Now, an interesting thing about this is that both of these terms have a cosine theta in them. That means the potential at z equals 0 on that entire plane at z equals 0 has 0 potential for our solution. And so, in fact, we have solved another problem that we didn't mention yet. The problem of having a grounded sphere, or actually hemisphere, sitting on a conducting grounded plane, conducting plane. So because for that we would need zero potential here on the sphere. We've already arranged that. That was the whole point of the problem we just solved. But in the end, that made phi equals zero on this plane also. So we've basically solved that with the same mathematics. If you like, we could calculate the surface charge induced on the sphere, the grounded sphere, by placing it into an electric field. Again, that's our usual formula. Sigma of A theta is minus epsilon naught outside a conductor minus epsilon naught d phi dr, which is the electric field just outside the conductor. Well, that derivative is trivial to take. Epsilon naught E naught cos theta plus epsilon naught E naught 2 A cubed over A cos theta. I think I mean A cubed here. I think that's a typo in my notes. Right, the 2 came from that, but should be, and a minus plus. Okay, you might correct that in your notes. I seem to have left off the exponent here. So finally, sigma of A theta is 3 epsilon naught E naught cosine theta is the charge density on the surface of the sphere. And notice that its integral vanishes. Right, if you do the integral of sigma d area, this will be sigma of theta, and then you'll have a sine theta d phi d theta a squared. That is clearly going to be zero. So the total charge, there is no total net charge induced. Okay, I'm out of time, and that's also a good stopping point. Next time, we will work out the Dirichlet-Green's function for the sphere. And it's hard to have more fun than that. See you then. Don't be shy about coming to office hours.